healed is assumed to have refused satisfaction. He can be assaulted wherever he is found, and an armiger or an exultant can engage assassins without soiling his honor. The scullion, who had been standing by the stair listening to all this and nodding, moved aside for her master, the innkeeper.
"Sir," he said, "if you indeed have a mortal appointing, I..."
"That is just what my friend was saying," I told him. "We must go." Dorcas asked then if she might have some wine. Somewhat surprised, I nodded. The innkeeper poured her a glass, which she held in both hands like a child. I asked him if he supplied riding implements for his guests.
"You wish to make a testament, sir. Come with me. We have a bower reserved for that purpose. There's no charge, and if you like, I will engage a boy who'll carry the document to your executor."
I picked up Terminus Est and followed him, leaving Agia and Dorcas to keep watch in the Avern. The bower our host boasted of was perched on a small limb and hardly big enough to hold a desk. But there was a stool there, several crow quill pens, paper, and a pot of ink. I sat down and wrote out the words of the note. So far as I could judge, the paper was the same as that on which it had been written, and the ink gave the same faded black line. When I had sanded my scribble, folded it, and tucked it away in a compartment of my sabretash I seldom used, I told the innkeeper no messenger would be required, and asked if he knew anyone named Trudeau.
"Trudeau, sir."
He looked puzzled. "Yes, it's a common enough name."
"Surely it is, sir, I know that. It's just that I was trying to think of somebody that might be known to me, and somebody, if you understand me, sir, in your exalted position, some armiger or..."
"Anyone," I said. "Anyone at all. It would not, for example, be the name of the waiter who served us, would it?"
"No, sir. His name's Owen. I had a neighbor once named Trudeau, sir, but that was years ago, before I bought this place. I don't suppose it would be him you're after? Then there's my ostler here. His name's Trudeau."
"I'd like to speak to him." The innkeeper nodded, his chin vanishing in the fat that circled his neck.
"As you wish, sir. Not that he's likely to be able to tell you much."
The steps creaked beneath his weight.
"He's from far south, I warn you."
He meant the southern regions of the city, not the wild and largely treeless lands abutting on the ice.
"And from across the river to boot. You're not likely to get much sense from him, though he's a hard-working fellow."
I said, "I suspect I know what part of the city he comes from."
"Do you now? Well, that's interesting, sir. Very interesting. I've heard one or two say they could tell such things by the way a man dressed or how he spoke. But I wasn't aware you'd laid eyes on Trudeau, as the saying is."
We were nearing the ground now, and he bawled,
"Trudeau! Trudeau!"
And then,
"Rains!"
No one appeared. A single flagstone the size of a large tabletop had been laid at the foot of the stair, and we stepped out upon it. It was just at that moment when lengthening shadows cease to be shadows at all and become instead pools of blackness, as if some fluid, darker even than the waters of the Lake of Birds, was rising from the ground. Hundreds of people, some alone, some in small groups, were hurrying over the grass from the direction of the city. All seemed intent, bowed by an eagerness they carried upon their backs and shoulders like a pack. Most bore no weapons I could see, but a few had cases of rapiers, and at some distance off I made out the white blossom of an avern, carried, it seemed, on a pole or staff, just as mine was.
"Pity they won't stop here,"
the innkeeper said.
"Not that I won't get some of them coming back. But a dinner before is where the money is." I speak frankly, for I can see that, young as you are, sir, you're too sensible not to know that every business is run to make a profit. I try to give good value. And as I've said, we've a famous kitchen. Trudeau! I have to have one, for no other sort of food will agree with me. I'd starve, sir, if I had to eat what most do. Trudeau, you louse farm, where are you?
A dirty boy appeared from somewhere behind the trunk, wiping his nose on his arm.
He's not back there, master.
Well, where is he? Go look for him.
I was still watching the streaming hundreds. They are all going to the sanguinary field, then. For the first time, I think I fully realized that I was liable to die before the moon shone. Accounting for the note seemed futile and childish.
Not all to fight, you understand. Most are only going to watch. There's some come only once because somebody they know's fighting, or just because they were told about it, or read about it, or heard a song. Usually those get taken ill because they come here and generally put away a bottle or so when they're getting over it. But there's others that come every night, or anyway, 4 or 5 nights out of the week. They're specialist, and only follow one weapon, or perhaps two. And they pretend to know more about those than them that use them, which perhaps some do. After your victory, sir, 2 or 3 will want to buy you a round. If you let them, they'll tell you what you did wrong and what the other man did wrong. But you'll find they don't agree.
I said, "Our dinner is to be private." And as I spoke, I heard the whisper of bare feet on the steps behind us. Agia and Dorcas were coming down. Agia carrying the Avern, which seemed to me to have grown larger in the failing light. I have already told you how strongly I desired Agia. When we are talking to women, we talk as though love and desire are 2 separate entities. And women, who often love us and sometimes desire us, maintain the same fiction. The fact is that they are aspects of the same thing, as I might have talked to the innkeeper of the north side of his tree and the south. If we desire a woman, we soon come to love her for her condescension in submitting to us. This, indeed, had been the original foundation of my love for Thecla. And since, if we desire her, she always submits in imagination, at least, some element of love is ever present. On the other hand, if we love her, we soon come to desire her, since attraction is one of the attributes a woman should possess. And we cannot bear to think she is without any of them. In this way, men come to desire even women whose legs are locked in paralysis, and women to desire those men who are impotent, save with men like themselves. But no one can say from what it is that what we call, almost at our pleasure, love or desire is born. As Agia came down the stair, one side of her face was lit by the last light of day, and the other thrown into shadow. Her skirt split nearly to the waist, permitted a flash of silken thigh, and all I had lost in feeling for her a few moments before, when I had pushed her away, came back doubled and doubled again. She saw that in my face, I know. And Dorcas, hardly a step behind her, saw it too and looked away. But Agia was angry with me still, as perhaps she had a right to be. So although she smiled for policy's sake, and could not have concealed the ache in her loins if she would, yet she withheld much. I think it is in this that we find the real difference between those women to whom, if we are to remain men, we must offer our lives, and those who, again, if we are to remain men, we must overpower and outwit if we can, and use as we never would a beast. That the second will never permit us to give them what we give the first. Agia enjoyed my admiration and would have been moved to ecstasy by my caresses. But even if I were to pour myself into her 100 times, we would part strangers. I understood all this as she descended the last few steps, one hand closing the bodice of her gown, the other upholding the avern, whose pole she used as a staff and carried like a bacchus. And yet I loved her still, or would have loved her if I could. The boy came running up.
"Trudeau's gone, Cook says. She was out fetching water 'cause the girl was gone and seen him running off, and his things is gone from the mews, too."
"Gone for good, then," the innkeeper said. "When did he go, just now?"
The boy nodded.
"He heard you were looking for him, sir. That's what I'm afraid of. One of the others must have heard you asking me about the name and run and told him. Did he steal from you?"
I shook my head. He did me no harm, and I suspect he was trying to do good in whatever he did do. I'm sorry I cost you a servant.
The innkeeper spread his hands. "He'd some wages coming, so I won't lose by it."
As he turned away, Dorcas whispered,
"And I am sorry to have taken your joy from you upstairs. I would not have deprived you. But, Severian, I love you."
From somewhere not far off, the silver voice of the trumpet called to the renascent stars. Chapter 27. Is he dead? The sanguinary field, of which all my readers will have heard, though some, I hope, will never have visited it, lies northwest of the built sections of our capital of Nessus, between a residential enclave of city armagers and the barracks and stables of the Xenogy of the Blue Demarquis. It is near enough the wall to seem very near to someone like myself, who had never been near it at all, yet still leagues of hard walking by twisted avenues from the actual base. How many combats can be accommodated, I do not know. It may be that the railings that delimit the grounds of each, upon which the spectators lean or sit as the fancy takes them, can be moved and are adjusted to suit the evening's needs. I have only visited the spot once, but it seemed to me, with its trampled grass and silent, languid watchers, a strange and melancholy one. During the brief time I have occupied the throne, many issues have been of more immediate concern than monomachy. Whether it is good or evil, as I am inclined to think, it is surely ineradicable in a society such as ours, which must, for its own survival, hold the military virtues higher than any others, and in which so few of the armed retainers of the state can be spared to police the populace. Yet is it evil? Those ages that have outlawed it, and many hundreds have, by my reading, have replaced it largely with murder, and with just such murders, by and large, as monomachy seems designed to prevent. Murders resulting from quarrels among families, friends, and acquaintances. In these cases, two die instead of one, for the law tracks down the slayer, a person not by disposition a criminal but by chance, and slays him, as though his death would restore his victim's life. Thus, if, say, 1,000 legal combats between individuals resulted in 1,000 deaths, which is very unlikely, since most such combats do not terminate in death, but prevented 500 murders, the state would be no worse. Further, the survivor of such a combat is likely to be the individual most suited to defending the state, and also the most suited to engendering healthy children. While there is no survivor of most murders, and the murderer, were he to survive, is likely to be only vicious, and not strong, quick, or intelligent. And yet how readily this practice lends itself to intrigue. We heard the shouted names when we were still 100 strides away, loudly and formally announced above the trilling of the hylas. Cadro of the 17 Stones, Sabas of the Parted Meadow, Laurentia of the House of the Harp, this in a woman's voice.
Cadro of the 17 Stones!
I asked Adja who it was who thus called.
They have given challenges, or have been challenged themselves. By bawling their names, or having a servant do it for them, they advertise that they have come, and to the world that their opponent has not.
Cadro of the 17 Stones!
The vanishing sun, whose disk was now a quarter concealed behind the impenetrable blackness of the wall, had dyed the sky with gamboge and cerise, vermilion and lurid violet. These colors, falling upon the throng of monomachists and loungers, much as we see the aureate beams of divine favor fall on hierarchs in art, lent them an appearance insubstantial and thaumaturgic, as though they had all been produced a moment before by the flourish of a cloth, and would vanish into the air again at a whistle.
Laurentia of the House of the Harp!
Adieu, I said, and from somewhere nearby we heard the choking death mix in a man's throat. Adieu, you are to call out Severian of the Montachin Tower.
I'm not your servant. Bawl it yourself if you want it bawled.
Cadro of the 17 Stones!
Don't look at me like that, Severian. I wish we hadn't come. Severian! Severian of the Torturers! Severian of the Citadel! Of the Tower of Pain! Death! Death is come!
My hand caught her just below the ear and she went sprawling, the Avern on its pole beside her. Dorcas gripped my arm.
You ought not have done that, Severian. It was only the flat of my hand. She'll be all right. She will hate you even more.
Then you think she hates me now? Dorcas did not answer. And a moment later, I myself forgot for the time being that I had asked the question. Some distance away among the crowd, I had seen an Avern. The ground was a level circle some 15 strides across, railed off save for an entrance at either end. The Ephor called.
The adjudication of the Avern has been offered and accepted. Here is the place. The time is now. It only remains to be decided whether you will engage as you are, naked or otherwise. How say you?
Before I could speak, Dorcas called, Naked! That man is in armor.
The Septentrion's grotesque helm swung from side to side in negation. Like most cavalry helmets, it left the ears bare to better hear the grazel and the shouted orders of the wearer's superiors. In the shadow behind the cheekpiece, I thought I saw a narrow band of black and tried to recall where I had seen such a thing before. The F4 asked,
You refuse, Hipparch?
The men of my country do not go naked, save in the presence of women alone.
He wears armor, Dorcas called again. This man has not even a shirt.
Her voice, always so soft before, rang in the twilight like a bell.
I will remove it.
The Septentrion threw back his cape and raised a gauntleted hand to the shoulder of his cuirass. It slipped from him and fell at his feet. I had expected a chest as massive as Master Gerloz's, but the one I saw was narrower than my own.
The helmet also.
Again the Septentrion shook his head, and the Ephor asked,
Your refusal is absolute?
It is.
There was a barely perceptible hesitation.
I can only say that I am instructed not to remove it.
The F4 turned to me. We none of us would desire, I think, to embarrass the Hipparch, and still less the personage, I do not say whom it may be, that he serves. I believe the wisest course would be to allow you, sir, some compensating advantage. Have you one to suggest? Agia, who had been silent since I had struck her, said,
Refuse the combat, Severian, or reserve your advantage until you need it.
Dorcas, who was loosening the strips of rag that bound the Avern, said also,
Refuse the combat.
I've come too far to turn back now. The F4 asked pointedly, Have you decided, sir? I think I have. My mask was in my sabretash. Like all those used in the guild, it was of thin leather stiffened with strips of bone. Whether it would keep out the thrown leaves of the Avern, I had no way of knowing, but it was satisfying to hear the lookers-on draw breath when I snapped it open. You are ready now? Hipparch?
Sire?
Sire, you must give that sword to someone to hold for you. No weapon but the Avern may be carried. I looked about for Agia, but she had vanished into the crowd. Dorcas handed me the deadly blossom, and I gave her Terminus Est. Begin! A leaf whizzed close to my ear. The Septentrion was advancing with an irregular motion, his Avern gripped beneath the lowest leaves by his left hand, and his right thrust forward as though to wrestle mine from me. I recall that Agia had warned me of the danger of this, and clasped it as close as I dared. For the space of 5 breaths we circled. Then I struck at his outstretched hand. He countered with his plant. I raised my own above my head like a sword, and as I did so realized the position was an ideal one. It put the vulnerable stem out of my opponent's reach, permitted me to slash downward with the whole plant at will, yet allowed me to detach leaves with my right hand. This last discovery I put to the test at once, snapping off a leaf and sending it skimming toward his face. Despite the protection his helm gave him, he ducked, and the crowd behind him scattered to avoid the missile. I followed it with another, and then another, which struck his own in flight. The result was remarkable. Instead of absorbing the other's momentum and clattering down together as inanimate blades would, the leaves appeared to writhe and wind their edged lengths about each other, slashing and striking with their points so rapidly that before they had fallen a cubit, they were no more than ragged strips of blackish green that turned to 100 colors and spun like a child's top. Something or someone was pressing against my back. It was as though an unknown stood close behind me, his spine against mine, exerting a slight pressure. I felt cold and was grateful for the warmth of his body.
Severian!
The voice was Dorcas's, but she seemed to have wandered away.
Severian! Won't anyone help him? Let me go!
The peal of a carillon. The colors, which I had taken to be those of the struggling leaves, were in the sky instead, where a rainbow unrolled beneath the aurora. The world was a great paschal egg, crowded with all the colors of the palette. Near my head a voice inquired, Is he dead? And someone answered matter-of-factly, That's it. Those things always kill. Unless you want to see them drag him off. The Septentrion's voice, oddly familiar, said, I claim victor right to his clothing and weapons. Give me that sword. I sat up. The leaves were still faintly struggling wisps a few paces from my boots. The Septentrion stood beyond them, still holding his Avern. I drew breath to ask what had happened, and something fell from my chest to my lap. It was a leaf, with the blood-stained tip. Seeing me, the Septentrion whirled and lifted his avern. The Air Force stepped between us, arms extended. From the railing, some spectator called, gentle right, soldier, let him stand up and get his weapon. My legs would hardly bear me. I looked around, stupidly, for my own avern, and found it at last only because it lay near the feet of Dorcas, who was struggling with Agia. The Septentrion shouted,
he should be dead!
The Ephor said, he is not, Hipparch. When he regains his weapon, you may pursue the combat. I touched the stem of my avern, and for an instant felt I had grasped the tail of some cold-blooded but living animal. It seemed to stir in my hand, and the leaves rattled. Agia was shouting,
sacrilege!
And I paused to look at her, then picked up the avern and turned to face the Septentrion. His eyes were shadowed by his helmet, but there was terror in every line of his body. For a moment he seemed to look from me to Agia. Then he turned and fled toward the opening in the rails at his end of the arena. The spectators blocked his way, and he used his avern like a scourge, striking to right and left. There was a scream, then a crescendo of screams. My own avern was pulling me backward, or rather, my avern was gone and someone gripped me by the hand.
Dorcas. Somewhere far away, Agia shrieked, Agilus!
And another woman called, Laurentia of the House of the Harp. Chapter 28 Carnifex. I woke the next morning in a lazaret, a long, high-ceilinged room where we the sick, the injured, lay upon narrow beds. I was naked, and for a long time, while sleep, or perhaps it was death, tugged at my eyelids, I moved my hands slowly over my body, searching it for injuries, while I wondered, as I might have wondered of someone in a song, how I would live without clothing or money, how I should explain to Master Palaemon the loss of the sword and cloak he had given me. For I was sure they were lost, or rather, that I was myself in some way lost from them. An ape, with the head of a dog, ran down the aisle, paused at my bed to look at me, then ran on. That seemed no stranger to me than the light that, passing through a window I could not see, fell upon my blanket. I woke again and sat up. For a moment I truly thought I was in our dormitory again, that I was captain of apprentices, that everything else, my masking, the death of Thecla, the combat of the Averns, had been only a dream. This was not the last time this was to happen. Then I saw that the ceiling was of plaster, and not our familiar metal one, and that the man in the bed next to my own was swathed in bandages. I threw back the blanket and swung my feet to the floor. Dorcas sat, asleep, with her back to the wall at the head of my bed. She had wrapped herself in the brown mantle. Terminus est lay across her lap, the hilt and scabbard tip protruding from either side of my heaped belongings. I managed to get my boots and hose, my breeches, my cloak, and my belt with its saber tash without waking her. But when I tried to take my sword, she murmured and clung to it. So I left it with her. Many of the sick were awake and stared at me, but none spoke. A door at the end of the room opened onto a flight of steps, and these descended to a courtyard where destriers stamped. For a moment I thought I was dreaming still. The cynocephalus was climbing up the crenellations of the wall. But it was an animal as real as the champing steeds, and when I threw a bit of rubbish at it, it bared teeth as impressive as Triskel's.
A trooper in a hauberk came out to get something from his saddlebag, and I stopped him and asked where I was. He supposed that I meant in what part of the fortress, and pointed out a turret behind which he said was the Hall of Justice, then told me that if I would come with him, I could probably get something to eat. As soon as he spoke, I realized I was famished. I followed him down a dark hallway, into a room much lower and darker than the lazarette, where 2 or 3 score demarchi, like himself, were bent over a midday meal of fresh bread, beef, and boiled greens. My new friend advised me to take a plate and tell the cooks I had been instructed to come here for my dinner. I did so, and though they looked a trifle surprised at my Fuligian cloak, they served me without objection. If the cooks were incurious, the soldiers were curiosity itself. They asked my name and where I came from and what my rank was, for they assumed our guild was organized like the military. They asked where my axe was, and when I told them we used the sword, where that was. And when I explained that I had a woman with me who was watching it, they cautioned me that she might run away with it, and then counseled me to carry out bread for her under my cloak, since she would not be permitted to come where we were to eat. I discovered that all the older men had supported women, camp followers of what is perhaps the most useful and least dangerous kind, at one time or another, though few had them now. They had spent the summer before in fighting in the north, and had been sent to winter in Nessus, where they served to maintain order. Now they expected to go north again within a week. Their women had returned to their own villages to live with parents or relatives. I asked if the women would not have preferred to follow them south. "Prefer it," said my friend. "Of course they'd prefer it. But how would they do it? It's one thing to follow cavalry that's fighting its way north with army, for that doesn't make more than a league or two on the best days, and if it clears 3 in a week, you can bet it will lose 2 the next. But how would they keep up on the way back to the city? 15 leagues a day? And what would they eat on the way? It's better for them to wait. If a new Xenogy comes to our old sector, they'll have some new men. Some new girls will come too, and some of the old ones drop out, and it gives everyone a chance to change off if they want. I heard they brought in one of you Carnifexes last night, but he was nearly dead himself. Have you been to see him? I said I had not. One of our patrols reported him, and when the Kiliarch heard of it, he sent them back to bring him, seeing we were sure to need one in a day or so. They swear they didn't touch him, but they had to bring him back on a litter. I don't know if he's one of your comrades, but you might want to take a look. I promised I would, and after thanking the soldiers for their hospitality, left them. I was worried about Dorcas, and their questioning, though it was clearly well meant, had made me uneasy. There were too many things I could not explain. How I had come to be injured, for example, if I had admitted I was the man who had been carried in the night before, and where Dorcas had come from. Not really understanding those things myself bothered me at least as much, and I felt, as we always feel when there is a whole sector of our lives that cannot bear light, that no matter how far the last question had been from one of the forbidden subjects, the next would pierce to the heart of it. Dorcas was awake and standing by my bed, where someone had left a cup of steaming broth. She was so delighted to see me that I felt happy myself, as though joy were as contagious as a pestilence. "I thought you were dead," she told me. "You were gone, and your clothes were gone, and I thought they had taken them to bury you in." "I'm all right," I said. "What happened last night?" Dorcas became serious at once. I made her sit on the bed with me and eat the bread I had brought and drink the broth while she answered.
You remember fighting with the man who wore that strange helmet, I'm sure. You put on a mask and went into the arena with him, although I begged you not to. Almost at once, he hit you in the chest and you fell. I remember seeing the leaf. A horrible thing like a flatworm made of iron, half in your body, and turning red as it drank your blood. Then it fell away. I don't know how to describe it. It was as though everything I had seen had been wrong. But it wasn't wrong. I remember what I saw. You got up again, and you looked, I don't know, as if you were lost or some part of you was far away. I thought he was going to kill you at once, but the Ephor protected you, saying he had to allow you to get your Avern. His was quiet, the way yours had been when you pulled it up in that awful place, but yours had begun to writhe and open its flower. I thought it had been open before, the white thing with the swirl of petals, only now I believe I was thinking too much of roses, and it had not been open at all. There was something underneath, something else. A face, like the face poison would have if poison had a face. You didn't notice. You picked it up and it began to curl toward you, slowly as though it were only half awake. But the other man, the Hipparch, couldn't believe what he had seen. He was staring at you. And that woman, Adja, was shouting to him. And all at once he turned and ran away. The people who were watching didn't want him to. They wanted to see someone killed, so they tried to stop him, and he... Her eyes were brimming with tears. She turned her head to keep me from seeing them. I said, "He struck several of them with his Avern, and I suppose killed them." "Then what happened?"
"It wasn't just that he struck them. It struck at them, after the first two, like a snake. The ones who were cut with the leaves didn't die at once. They screamed, and some of them ran and fell and got up and ran again, as if they were blind, knocking other people down. And at last, a big man struck him from behind, and a woman who had been fighting somewhere else came with a Brachomar. She cut the Avern, not sidewise, but down the stem so it split. Then some of the men held the Hipparch, and I heard her blade clash on his helmet. You were just standing there. I wasn't sure you even knew he was gone, and your Avern was bending back toward your face. I thought of what the woman had done and hit at it with your sword. It was heavy, so very heavy at first, and then it was hardly heavy at all. But when I slashed down with it, I felt as if I could have struck the head from a bison. Only I had forgotten to take off the sheath. But it knocked the Avern out of your hand, and I took you and led you away.
"Where?"
I asked.
She shivered and dipped a piece of bread in the steaming broth.
"I don't know. I didn't care. It was just so good to be walking with you, to know I was taking care of you the way you had taken care of me before we got the Avern. But I was cold, terribly cold, when night came. I put your cloak all around you and fastened it in front, and you didn't seem to be cold, so I took this mantle and wrapped myself in it. My dress was falling to pieces. It still is."
I said, "I wanted to buy you another one when we were at the inn."
She shook her head, chewing the tough crust. "Do you know, I think this is the first food I've had in a long, long time. I have pains in my stomach. That's why I drank the wine there. But this makes it feel better. I hadn't realized how weak I was getting. But I didn't want a new dress from there, because I would have had to wear it for a long time, and it would always have reminded me of that day. You can buy me a dress now if you like.
because it will remind me of this day, when I thought you were dead, when you were really well. Anyway, we got back into the city somehow. I was hoping to find a place to stop where you could lie down, but there were only big houses with terraces and balustrades, that sort of thing. Some soldiers came galloping up and asked if you were Carnifex. I didn't know the word, but I remembered what you had told me, and so I told them you were a torturer, because soldiers have always seemed to me to be a kind of torturer, and I knew they would help us. They tried to get you to ride, but you fell off. So some of them tied their capes between two lances and laid you on that, and put the ends of the lances in the stirrup straps of two destriers. One of them wanted to take me up into his saddle, but I wouldn't do it. I walked beside you all the way, and sometimes I talked to you, but I don't think you heard me.
She drained the last of the broth.
Now, I want to ask you a question. When I was washing myself behind the screen, I could hear you and Adya whispering about a note. Later, you were looking for someone in the inn. Will you tell me about that?
Why didn't you ask before?
Because Adya was with us. If you had found out anything, I didn't want her to hear what it was.
I'm sure Adya could discover anything I discovered.
I said,
I don't know her well, and in fact, I don't feel I know her as well as I know you. But I know her well enough to realize that she's much cleverer than I am.
Dorcas shook her head again. She's the sort of woman who's good at making puzzles for other people, but not at solving ones she didn't make herself. I think she thinks, I don't know, sidewise, so no one else can follow it. She's the kind of woman people say thinks like a man. But those women don't think like real men at all. In fact, they think less like real men than most women do. They just don't think like women. The way they do think is hard to follow. But that doesn't mean it's clear or deep.
I told her about the note and what it said, and mentioned that although it had been destroyed, I had copied it out on the inn's paper and found it to be the same paper and the same ink.
So someone wrote it there,
she said pensively.
Probably one of the inn servants, because he called the ostler by name. But what does it mean?
I don't know.
I can tell you why it was put where it was. I sat there, on that horn settee, before you sat down. It made me happy, I recall, because you sat beside me. Do you remember if the waiter, he must have carried the note, whether he wrote it or not, put the tray there before I got up to bathe?
I can remember everything, I said, except last night. Adya sat in a folding canvas chair. You sat on the couch, that's right, and I sat down beside you. I had been carrying the Avern on the pole as well as my sword, and I laid the Avern flat behind the couch. The kitchen girl came in with water and towels for you. Then she went out and got oil and rags for me.
Dorcas said, "We ought to have given her something."
I gave her an orichalk to bring the screen. That's probably as much as she's paid for a week. Anyway, you went behind it, and a moment later the host led the waiter in with the tray and wine.
That's why I didn't see it then. But the waiter must have known where I was sitting, because there was no place else. So he left it under the tray, hoping I'd see it when I came out. What was the first part again?
The woman with you has been here before. Do not trust her.
It must have been for me. If it had been for you, it would have distinguished between Adya and me.
probably by hair color. And if it had been meant for Agia, it would have been out on the other side of the table, where she would have seen it instead.
So you reminded someone of his mother?
Yes.
Once more, there were tears in her eyes. You're not old enough to have had a child who could have written that note.
I don't remember,
she said, and buried her face in the loose folds of the brown mantle. Chapter 29 Agilis. When the physician in charge had examined me and found I had no need of treatment, he asked us to leave the lazarette, where my cloak and sword were, as he said, upsetting to his patients. On the opposite side of the building in which I had eaten with the troopers, we found a shop that catered to their needs. Together with false jewelry and trinkets of the sort such men give their paramours, it carried a certain amount of women's clothing. And though my money had been much depleted by the dinner we had never returned to the Inn of Lost Loves to enjoy, I was able to buy Dorcas a simar. The entrance to the Hall of Justice was not far from the shop. A crowd of 100 or so was milling before it, and since the people pointed and elbowed one another when they caught sight of my phylogen, we retreated again to the courtyard where the destriers were tethered. A port reeve from the Hall of Justice found us there, an imposing man with a high white forehead like the belly of a pitcher.
"You are the Carnifex," he said. "I was told you are well enough to perform your office."
I told him I could do whatever was necessary today, if his master required it.
"Today, no, that's not possible. The trial won't be over until this afternoon."
I remarked that since he had come to make certain I was well enough to carry out the execution, he must have felt certain the prisoner would be found guilty.
"Oh, there's no question of that, not the least. 9 persons died, after all, and the man was apprehended on the spot. He's of no consequence, so there's no possibility of pardon or appeal. The tribunal will reconvene at mid-morning, but you won't be required until noon."
Because I had had no direct experience with judges or courts, at the Citadel our clients had always been sent to us, and Master Gerloz dealt with those officials who occasionally came to inquire about the disposition of some case or other. And because I was eager to actually perform the act in which I had been drilled for so long, I suggested that the Kiliarch might wish to consider a torchlight ceremony that same night.
"That would be impossible. He must meditate his decision."
"How would it look? A great many people feel already that the military magistrates are hasty and even capricious. And to be frank, a civil judge would probably have waited a week, and the case would be all the better for it, since there would have been ample time then for someone to come forward with fresh evidence, which, of course, no one will actually do."
"Tomorrow afternoon, then," I said. "We'll require quarters for the night. Also, I'll want to examine the scaffold and block and ready my client. Will I need a pass to see him?"
The port reeve asked if we could not stay in the lazarette, and when I shook my head, we, the port reeve, Dorcas, and I, went there to permit him to argue with the physician in charge, who, as I had predicted, refused to have us. That was followed by a lengthy discussion with a non-commissioned officer of the Xenogy, who explained that it was impossible for us to stay in the barracks with the troopers, and that if we were to use one of the rooms set aside for the higher ranks, no one would want to occupy it in the future. In the end, a little windowless storeroom was cleared out for us, and 2 beds and some other furniture, all of which had seen hard use, brought in. I left Dorcas there, and after assuring myself that I was unlikely to step through a rotten board at the critical moment, or to have to saw the client's head off while I held him across my knee, I went to the cells to make the call that our traditions demand. Subjectively, at least,
There is a great difference between detention facilities to which one has become accustomed and those to which one has not. If I had been entering our own oubliette, I would have felt I was, quite literally, coming home. Perhaps coming home to die, but coming home nevertheless. Although I would have realized in the abstract that our winding metal corridors and narrow gray doors might hold horror for the men and women confined there, I would have felt nothing of that horror myself. And if one of them had suggested I should, I would have been quick to point out their various comforts. Clean sheets and ample blankets, regular meals, adequate light, privacy that was scarcely ever interrupted, and so on. Now, going down a narrow and twisted stone stair, into a facility 1/100th the size of ours, my feelings were precisely the reverse of what I would have felt there. I was oppressed by the darkness and stench as if by a weight. The thought that I might myself be confined there by some accident, a misunderstood order, for example, or some unsuspected malice on the part of the Portreeve, recurred, no matter how often I pushed it aside. I heard the sobbing of a woman, and because the Portreeve had spoken of a man, assumed that it came from a cell other than the one that held my client. That, I had been told, was the third from the right. I counted 1, 2, and 3. The door was merely wood bound with iron, but the locks, such is military efficiency, had been oiled. Within, the sobbing hesitated and almost ceased as the bolt fell back. Inside, a naked man lay upon straw. A chain ran from the iron collar about his neck to the wall. A woman, naked too, bent over him, her long brown hair falling past her face and his, so that it seemed to unite them. She turned to look at me, and I saw that it was Agia. She hissed, "Agilis!" And the man sat up. Their faces were so nearly alike that Agia might have been holding a mirror to her own. "It was you," I said. "But that is impossible." Even while I spoke, I was recalling the way Agia had behaved at the sanguinary field and the strip of black I had seen by the Hipparch's ear. "You," Agia said. "Because you lived, he has to die." I could only answer, "Is it really Agilis?" "Of course." My client's voice was an octave lower than his twin's, though less steady. "You still don't understand, do you?" I could only shake my head. "It was Agia in the shop, in the Septentrion costume. She came in through the rear entrance while I was speaking to you, and I made a sign to her when you wouldn't even talk of selling the sword." Agia said, "I couldn't speak. You would have known it for a woman's voice, but the cuirass hid my breasts and the gauntlets my hands. Walking like a man isn't as hard as men think." "Have you ever looked at that sword? The tang should be signed." Agilis's hands lifted for a moment, as though he would have taken it still if he could. Agia added in a toneless voice, "It is, by Jovinian. I saw it in the inn." There was a tiny window high up on the wall behind them, and from it, suddenly, as though the ridge of a roof, or a cloud, had now fallen below the sun, a beam of light came to bathe them both. I looked from one aureate face to the other. "You tried to kill me. Just for my sword."
Adjula said.
I hoped you would leave it. Don't you remember? I tried to persuade you to leave, to flee in disguise. I would have given the clothes to you, and as much money as I could.
Severian, don't you understand? It was worth 10 times more than our shop, and the shop was all we had.
You've done this before. You must have. Everything went too smoothly. A legal murder, with no body to wait for guile.
You're going to kill Agilis, aren't you? That must be why you're here. But you didn't know it was us until you opened the door. What have we done that you're not going to do?
Less stridently, her brother's voice followed Agius. It was a fair combat. We were equally armed, and you agreed to the conditions. Will you give me such a fight tomorrow? You knew that when evening came, the warmth of my hands would stimulate the Avern, and that it would strike at my face. You wore gloves, and you only had to wait. In reality, you didn't even have to do that because you had thrown the leaves often before. Agilis smiled.
So the business of the gauntlets was a side issue after all.
He spread his hands.
I won. But in reality, you won by some concealed art. Neither my sister nor I understand. I have been wronged by you 3 times now, and the old law said that a man 3 times wronged might claim any boon of his oppressor. I grant that the old law is no longer in force, but my darling tells me you have an attachment to times past, when your guild was great and your fortress the center of the commonwealth. I claim the boon. Set me free.
Agia rose, brushing the straw from her knees and rounded thighs, as though she realized only now that she was naked. She picked up the blue-green brocade gown I remembered so well and clasped it to her. I said,
"How have I wronged you, Agilis?
It seems to me that you have wronged me, or tried to.
First by entrapment.
You carried an heirloom worth a villa about the city without knowing what it was you had. As owner, it was your duty to know. And your ignorance threatens to cost me my life tomorrow unless you free me tonight. Secondly, by refusing to entertain any offer to buy. In our commercial society, one may set one's price as high as one wishes, but to refuse to sell at any price is treason. Agia and I wore the gaudy armor of a barbarian. You wore his heart. Thirdly, by the sleight with which you won our combat. Unlike you, I found myself contesting powers greater than I could comprehend. I lost my nerve, as any man would. And here I am. I call on you to free me. Laughter came unwished for, carrying with it the taste of gall.
You're asking me to do for you, whom I have every reason to despise, what I wouldn't do for Thecla, whom I loved almost more than my own life? No. I'm a fool. And if I was not one before, surely your darling sister has made one of me. But not such a fool as that.
Agia dropped her gown and threw herself toward me with such violence that I thought for an instant she was attacking me.
Instead, she covered my mouth with kisses, and seizing my hands, put one on her breast and the other upon her velvet hip.